Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are going back to the European Parliament. We're going back a lot quicker than we generally do. We tend to nearly take 3 month breaks on this, Martin. You like to break things up into blocks, yeah?
Well, I think Luke McFlanagan last week and two more MEPs this week. We've done more European coverage than RTÉ's done in a year. That's great.
The dig is always that since Brian Hayes has moved on, there's nobody left to go on the media. But nonetheless, we'll move on. We are delighted to be joined by two, as Martin said, European MEPs for Ireland, Mick Wallace and Claire Daly. I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk to us.
No bother.
Thanks for having us.
Look, there's no easy way to come into this. This is because purely on a basis that there has been a lot of controversy at home and a controversy within Brussels, saying and accusations that you're an embarrassment to Ireland, and there's been accusations that you're swallowing propaganda. I just want to give you, before we have a conversation. When you read these headlines, you read these stories, I maybe go to you first, Claire. How do you feel that this representation that's been delivered back to people in Ireland is relative to how you feel about it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a weird one for us, because what we saw with, say, for example, the Irish Times last week, which conflated a whole load of issues and took comments and points we would have made in different environments and copied and pasted them in a manner which didn't give a full picture. For us, it's kind of part of what we're seeing increasingly here, is that people who give valid criticism in relation to foreign affairs issues are being characterised as sort of, disinformation or conspiracy theorists and all this. And it's a way to delegitimise, I suppose, constructive criticism of EU foreign policy. And we, as people who were elected on a platform of defending Ireland's neutrality and not getting involved in that type of new Cold War ratcheting up a gear, think we're being misrepresented in that. So it's a bit weird the way it's kind of come out of the blue all of a sudden as well, because there isn't tensions in the European Parliament, or isn't there? There isn't people going around talking about us. This has been fabricated largely, mainly by the Irish Times, to be honest. It's a bit of a weird one. What do you think, Mick?
Yeah, look, as maybe sometimes journalists do what they do to try and establish a name for themselves, feed into a wider audience. In this particular case, given of it how the story was handled, it's pretty obvious the journalist in question doesn't really have a very good understanding of foreign affairs matters and what's really happening, and hasn't really been following. I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Security and Defence Committee in the Parliament, and it's pretty obvious she hasn't been following those anyway, and which she should if she's going to be an Irish Times correspondent for the Parliament.
The European correspondent, Naomi O'Leary, she's not here to defend herself, so I think it's fair to say, though, some of the things that were said in the article do leave questions. I mean, like, myself and Martin covered, say, the recent conflict in Palestine and Gaza extensively. And we've looked at ways of actually going and visiting and the different ways in, and 90 days waiting for some sort of visa, all of this nonsense. Like, you guys walked into Damascus. How do you just walk into Damascus? Someone has to bring you there, Mick.
Not at all.
No, you don't. You know what you do? You get a flight to Beirut, yeah, right? And you can get a taxi to the airport, which is about little over an hour's drive, an hour and 20 minutes. And you go to the airport and they charge you $75 for a visa. And as long as you don't have an Israeli stamp in your passport, they'll let you in. If you have, they won't let you in.
Yeah, I mean, this is the third time we've been to Syria. We went twice to Syria when we were in the Irish Parliament, and other TDs came along with us. And we went on our own. We paid for our own trip. None of it was funded by the Syrian government or any of the Syrian authorities. We went through a travel agent who brought us around. Certainly in the early years, there were more issues of security than there are now, but we talked to whoever we liked. We went wherever we liked, and we bore testimony ourselves to what's going on in the ground there. So we think that's our job. It was the job we were doing before we came to the European Parliament, and it's the job we'll continue to do. We don't see it as in any way, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. What could possibly be wrong with that, to visit a country which has been, you know, the victims of a war for nearly 10 years now, who are at the butt of illegal sanctions, where the people are really suffering, and to see and experience and talk to people on the ground about how they feel and how they think the situation will be resolved. I think that's a responsible way to do, rather than what often happens here, is just demonising Syria as a country, saying, oh, you are going to visit Assad. You know, this is a sovereign country of 17 million people, like, so.
And recognised as a sovereign country by the UN. But obviously, the three occupying forces, the US, Turkey and Israel, are all three are in total breach of international law by occupying Syria. And obviously, it's very sad that the EU has supported the 10-year effort at regime change in Syria. And I mean, people at home haven't really... The truth about the war in Syria is probably still to reach most homes, and but history will be unkind to the Europeans, because they were prepared to support the US, Israeli, Saudi effort to bring about that regime change. And they did that by arming the jihadists and creating unbelievable turmoil in the country. We've a couple of 100,000 people have died. Millions have left the country. And it's a very sad situation. But the truth is now that the Syrian government, with the help of the Russians in particular, have won the war. But as Trump said last year, you know, should he get out of Syria? I want the oil. So they're actually stealing oil from Syria. Turkey is stealing wheat. Israel is occupying the Golan. And sadly, we have...
Is it really that simple, Mick?
Well, look, there's nothing simple. But I mean, it's a fact that these three countries are illegally occupying the country.
Again, I don't disagree with you on those bases, but there's also, I mean, you refer to 10 years, but it's a lot longer. Like, I mean, Bashar al-Assad's father laid waste to Homs. I mean...
Yeah, listen, I mean, we never defended the Assads. And we're well aware of the fact that an awful lot of leaders of countries in the region behave very badly, and the Assads have behaved badly too. But it doesn't change the fact that the present EU sanctions against Syria are illegal, and the only one is hurting is the people of Syria. Assad is living pretty well at the moment, I'd say. And I don't believe the sanctions are bothering him one iota, or bothering the government. They're bothering the citizens, though.
Absolutely. And I mean, it was one of the things I found really interesting about our visit this time, was that we got to go down to the Golan Heights. Now, this is, and again, we're talking about not our opinion, we're talking about international law declares that the Golan Heights are illegally occupied by Israel. And we were really shocked at what we saw there. We saw windmills, environmental windmills, in an area where there's no wind, I might add, erected on the Syrian occupied land by Israeli settlers. And, you know, there's a huge sympathy in Ireland for the people of Palestine, and rightly so, and the illegal annexation there. But actually, that's gone on in Syrian territory for decades now as well. And there are families on the other side of that boundary who can't come back to Syria, who can't reunite with their families. It's just appalling. And the Irish Defence Forces are there monitoring what's going on. So illegality is carried out there, and they just report on it. They don't actually do anything about it, and Israel is allowed fly over that and bomb Damascus, and nobody says anything.
Yeah, but I mean, it should be said, though, that UN mission...
Can I just put in there just for 1 second? Can I ask about the criticism that was in the Irish Times, and the criticism that even came this week from Barry Andrews in the EU? Do you accept any of the criticism that has been put forward by either the EU, the Irish Times, or Barry Andrews?
Like what?
Good point.
Well, first of all, we have to accept that Assad is a dictator. He is a mass murderer. We know that there are sanctions on the country. We know that sanctions hurt people, but they also hurt the regime.
No, well, these sanctions are illegal, right? They have no basis in international law. There is a procedure for lawful sanctions. These are not them. What Assad is and what he isn't is a matter for the people of Syria to decide for themselves. Now, I didn't fully hear the allegations of Barry Andrews. I mean, there were so many allegations, to be honest, which in the Irish Times, we can go through them one by one. But in terms of Syria and what Barry Andrews said, the first thing is, I think it's a bit weird that he's suddenly come out now and criticised us for a contribution we made when the head of the OPCW appeared before the Security and Defence Committee. Now, that was 3 months ago. And what we did was, people at home may not know this, so there was an alleged chemical attack in the city of Douma on the outskirts of Damascus in 2014. And a number of people were killed in that incident. And for the first time, international observers got in to carry out an investigation of what happened in that attack. Was it a chemical attack? Who was responsible for it? Whatever. Interestingly, it was an Irish man who headed that investigation and who was in charge of the scientific planning and research of that operation. Now, they went in on the ground, they did an analysis for the OPCW, which is the international sort of observation mission in this area, and they came out and they drew up a report, and it subsequently emerged that this man and his colleague, who became whistleblowers inside the OPCW, said that the report that they wrote, where they didn't find evidence of a chemical attack, not least that it was the responsibility of the Assad government or anybody else, was suppressed later on. Now, this isn't a conspiracy theory, this is a fact, that whistleblowers inside the OPCW have released this information.
There's other people who disagree.
There's other people who agree, and I'm going to tell you who they are. Subsequent to that, Jose Bustani, the founding director of the OPCW, Dennis Halliday, our own Ireland's Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck, the very people who exposed the false narrative about the false weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that gave rise to the war against Iraq and the slaughter of a million or more children there, not to mind the still ongoing trouble from that. These people have written a letter saying that the scientific basis for that analysis has been jeopardised, that the level of scrutiny and standard of proof required has not been met, and they've asked for certain procedures to be triggered. All we did was articulate their concerns. We didn't say one way or another. We said that the standard of proof has not been met. That's a fact. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's a fact. We didn't do anything more than that. And for Barry Andrews to claim that that's a threat on the internal democracy of the European Union is frankly exactly what I warned about in the Parliament yesterday in the same debate, that what's going on here is a suppression of criticism of the EU's foreign policy is being stigmatised. And I use the example of Nye Bevan when he said, you know, this is my truth, tell me yours, that actually Democrats come about an understanding through, you know, examining and explaining views, not through shouting people down and demonise them as disinformation or fake news or this type of stuff. Let's engage in the content.
But hang on, it is fair to say that there's alternative narratives, and both of those narratives, whataboutry doesn't mean that, you know, either a chemical attack or an atrocity didn't take place. Whataboutry doesn't mean that it, you know, doesn't meet the standard for what it was. I'm not trying to justify any of these attacks, but I'm also trying to be very clear on this, that, you know, the legacy of the awful conflict, as you guys have pointed out, has left people in Lebanon who can't return home, has left people across, you know, all of these awful things have taken place. A lot of this, yes, there's a wider geopolitical game, and I want to get into that with you because, obviously, you know, you've also visited Iraq. Go ahead, Mick. Sorry.
Yeah. Listen, on the first point, right, in relation to the OPCW, we are not saying that we know what happened. What we're saying is that there's whistleblowers from the OPCW. They were the only scientists who went on the ground for the OPCW to investigate the case. And their report was thrown in the bin and a new one written. And all we're asking for, we're asking the OPCW to have an internal investigation. We're not even asking for an independent one. We're asking for the OPCW to listen to the whistleblowers and investigate what really happened. Because we realise that for many years now, the OPCW has been a vital international organisation and its credibility is important. And we want its credibility to be maintained. And that won't happen unless the whistleblower's case is listened to and if there's an investigation, at least an internal one. On your second point about people ending up in Lebanon and Turkey and they can't go back. No, they can't go back. And do you know why they can't go back? The Syrian government is bending over backwards trying to get them back. The EU... Take Turkey, for example. The EU is presently paying Turkey 3 billion euros a year to cage those 3 million because they don't want them to come to Europe and they will not allow them to return to Syria because it will boost the country and because the people that return will engage in the rebuilding process. And the EU and the Americans don't want it. The EU don't want it because the Americans are telling them, don't do this. We're still working on regime change. So these people are not, there's a lot of these people, we've been all over Syria. And I can tell you what, I feel 100% safe there. And I wasn't being minded, right? And we know there's an awful lot of people in camps in Turkey, in Turkey and Lebanon, and they want to return and they're not being allowed.
Right, Mick, there are people in Denmark who are being told they need to leave certain communities due to other rules, but they're not in a rush to return either. So there aren't people there. Yeah. I'm just saying there's also it's not as easy. It's not as
okay.
Like Syria before the conflict was already, you know. There's many different tribes, if I can use that phrase, and maybe it's an unfortunate way.
No, I tell you what, Syria, and one of the problems that Israel had such a big problem with Syria is that Syria was a mosaic of ethnic groups, right? There were seven different religions in Syria, and they've actually lived together well for many, many years. And they had a problem with that. And it was an absolute perfect example of all the different groups getting on well together. So any narrative to the contrary is actually not true. And in terms of where was Syria, in terms of its economy and its well-being, things were progressing dramatically in Syria from 2000 on until the war. The war broke out. But, I mean, obviously things have changed since. I mean, and listen, I'm not saying that every refugee wants to return, because in particular the ones who took the side as jihadists against the Syrian government, I'm sure they have rightful concerns about returning.
It didn't start because they weren't jihadists when they started, Mick. We know this.
In 2011, Jake Sullivan, who is now Biden's advisor on matters in this area, or dealing with the EU as well. But Jake Sullivan boasted in 2011 in an email with Hillary Clinton that at least we have Al-Qaeda on our side in Syria. And WikiLeaks exposed that.
I mean, we've done a huge amount of work here in terms of the refugee issue. Our record in Ireland and here in the European Union in defending the rights of refugees and asylum seekers, including those from Syria, many of whom we know in Ireland, is unquestioned. So we're not saying that anybody who doesn't want to go back should be forced back. But there are people who want to go back as well. And that has to be acknowledged. And that doesn't mean, nobody is saying that Syria is a paradise now or it was a paradise before. The Assad government was an authoritarian government, and while changes have been made, more changes probably still need to be made. But that's a task for the people of Syria, and the Western powers coming in and using that as an arena to basically exercise regime change and destabilize that country. Well, it didn't work, but that was the plan. They wanted it to end up like Libya. I can tell you one thing, I'd much prefer to live in Syria than in Libya, because Mick's right, it's an incredibly mixed society, like, you know, there's Christians, Alawites, Jews, you can wear what you like, drink what you like, and it's so anybody who wants to go. If you want to go and visit, that can be arranged very easily, and you won't be going as guests of the government, like, you know.
One of the saddest things, obviously, I want to point out is that it was one of the last villages left in the world where Aramaic was still spoken. Mm.
It's still there.
We've been there twice.
Still there, and it's actually really rebuilt. We went 5 years ago. They had only begun to move back some families and make. They all had the Wexford Utes jerseys, and the kids played a football game there.
I organised really nice. A match. in the
but then when we went and we stayed with local families who'd been moved back into the area, when we went there 2 years ago, 3 years ago, it had been rebuilt a bit, but it's a lot rebuilt now. You know, no, it's not perfect, and the scars of the war are there. We're not saying that they're not. Like, you know, there was neighbour against neighbour. There were people killed there. It was appalling. And even, you know, some families haven't moved back to the area, and some of the other families wouldn't have them back. So this is the awful consequences of these types of war. But we got elected on a mandate of defending neutrality and arguing for peace. So that's what we want to do. We want to engage with the people of Syria to allow them to devise their own destiny, not be the puppets of a war of external forces. And it was, sadly, that's what happened in Iraq.
But they haven't been able to, Claire. There hasn't been free and fair elections. There hasn't been a proper opposition. Dissent is put down by Assad. So what do we do in the real world where he is a dictator? He's more than an authoritarian. He's a dictator who murders people en masse.
No,
do you have a problem with the fact that at the last count, America supports 70% of the dictators in the world? Have you a problem with... Have you a problem with the fact that there's no elections in Saudi or Bahrain or in UAE or Qatar? They don't do elections. Is that okay?
No, you see, I mean, Joe Biden, now hold on, do we say that Joe Biden or Donald Trump were mass murderers of, you know, thousands of people? Because as the heads of a country which did, whose army carried out the execution or murder or killing of loads of people, are they responsible for that? It's kind of similar with Assad. There have been changes made in the Syrian constitution. And gains and reforms have been won in the sense of some of the reforms that have been brought in. Is it enough? No. But there's loads of countries around the world where it isn't enough. I mean, when we went to Aleppo the last time with some other colleagues from the Dáil with us, we met people, business people, who, if they were in Ireland, they certainly wouldn't be hanging around with lefties and socialists, right? And they'd probably be in Fine Gael because they just wanted to make money. They had big factories in Aleppo. They were making money. And the Turks came in when the border opened, robbed all their factories, took all their machinery. They saw how the terrorists were allowed to come in from external, and they saw it with their own eyes. And they had been the people who were very much opposed to Assad. But when they saw, if you like, their domestic problems being hijacked, they rode in behind the administration.
If I could come in on that and just make the point, Western imperialism bad, right? Let's tell the truth here. We're not saying, but that doesn't lessen, you know, actors like Assad. It doesn't lessen. I mean, I do want to move us on.
We've never ever said that. One point on that, Tony, right?
See, yeah. I mean, obviously, myself and Claire, we've been challenging US imperialism for many years now, and we are challenging the EU foreign policy at the moment. We don't agree with an awful lot of things that go on in these countries. There isn't one government in the world that we'd say that we like. Not one. And what we're doing is we're highlighting the hypocrisy of the European Union. The Americans drop more bombs for every year for the last 30 years than the rest of the world combined each year. The Americans killed over 2 million people in that region from Afghanistan, Iraq, and they're supporting the genocide in Yemen at the moment, and the EU doesn't give out about it. Mm. The EU doesn't want to change the regime in Syria, which is an apartheid state carrying out a genocide against the Palestinians. They don't want to change that regime. So, I mean, listen, we... but. interfering in countries, from our point of view, is against international law. We think we would love Syria to have fair and free elections. We'd love that there wasn't an authoritarian government, because there is one, right? So we'd like that to change, but it's only the Syrian people that have the right to change it. In the UN Charter forbids interference, right?
I'll point out the listeners, and it was funny where the UN Charter was used to, EU Charter was used, that they said they couldn't interfere in what was happening in Catalonia and in Spain. Now I am. I'm pointing out the obvious hypocrisy there when they were happy enough to support other types of, you know, people who we didn't approve of. And let's face it, quite often people who are brown. But I'm conscious of time. So I do want to ask you, Iraq, Claire, same question almost I began with. Yeah. Were you invited there? Did you initiate it? Did you decide that, like, this was, you know, you'd been before, you want to see this, or how did you, or how was that arranged?
This was our trip. Mick, actually, believe it or not, is the rapporteur for Iraq for the European Parliament, which sounds like a big annoying word, but it basically means he is the person responsible for Iraq and our on behalf of the whole European Parliament. Now, obviously, if we had gone as an official parliamentary delegation, we'd be very confined into who we would meet and who would meet us. So we organised the trip ourselves with a very good, well-connected journalist based in Brussels, who I suppose was able to facilitate us in meeting people across the board. So we got access to politicians, to religious leaders, to community leaders, right across the country. I mean, that's probably...
And some military people.
And so, and this is the gas thing. So our visit is characterised that we went to Iraq to visit the Iran-backed Hashdashabi popular mobilised. No, we didn't. We went on a week-long delegation where we met people from across the political and religious sections of society, all of them, Kurds, everyone, Shias, the whole lot, because we don't want to take sides. And in the course of that, we met one of the militias. Now, there seems to be an absolutely appalling lack of understanding as to who these militias are and what they are. But the Popular Mobilisation Forces of Iraq, or Hashdashabi, as they were called, were the response to the failure of the US to respond to Iraq's plea to come in and help them deal with the occupation of a third of their country by ISIS. So ISIS had overrun huge swathes of Iraq. They were carrying out barbarous policies against women, children, the usual. And there was a call by some of the Grand Ayatollahs and others that there should be a response from the people at large in Iraq to defend themselves when the request to the Americans came on deaf ears. And the Popular Mobilisation Forces were formed. They did get help from Iran and they were very appreciative of that. But they were really clear that these groups are not Iran funded. They're not led by Iran. These are under the control of Iraqis themselves. They're I want to explain, because militia is a word that sounds weird and sort of mad. These groups are actually funded in many instances by the Iraqi government. So they're really like part of the Iraqi army, and they work with the army and they have the backing of the people. Now, the group we went to visit, and this is really interesting, is one of four battalions under the Hashda Majoria, right? Which sounds a bit mad to people in Iraq, but it's basically they are the battalions which were set up by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani. Now, Grand Ayatollah Sistani is the person who Pope Francis met a couple of weeks before we met. And I haven't seen anybody saying Pope Francis was going around, you know, murdering people or whatever, or sitting down with terrorists. But the group we met were the ones funded by Grand Ayatollah Sistani. There are no allegations of anything against that group other than that they rid their communities of ISIS. And, you know, anything else, to be honest with you, when that story started first, the only reason that was done was because there were most hideous pictures of me in a burqa looking like something out of The Life of Brian, or a sort of a mad version of Lisa Smith or something. And such is the sort of way this is covered, that actually people are led to believe that the Hashdashabi, some people I think would think that they're ISIS, the way things are presented in the media, and people aren't there thinking that that's who were me. These were the people who were, and I wore what I liked in Iraq, in the parts of Iraq where people wear what they like. But we had that meeting in the holy city of Najaf, and out of respect for that culture, I wore those clothes. I didn't like wearing them, but I respected the fact. And you know what I thought was really nice in some ways was when we had the meeting with one of the grand ayatollahs, and the first thing, and this was a man in his late 80s, and there was myself and another young woman, and we walked into the room, bunch of, you know, people. This was a really important man that we were meeting. We were really privileged to get an ear. Nobody in the EU would get to meet this man. And the first thing he said was, I'd like to thank the women for wearing these clothes, especially the young woman. That wasn't me, obviously. That was the other woman. They said, especially the young woman. We know how hard it is for you, but this is a mark of respect in our culture, in our holy town here. And the bile that was thrown on me on that, the misogyny and anti-Muslim inferences by people in the West, like Irish Times journalists and other people saying, oh, how could this feminist wear something like that when she's a reputation? You can wear what you like in Iraq. How dare she? She's just pandering to Iranian. How dare those people insult the Muslim women, the Muslims in Ireland and women in general, that women can't wear what they like just because some Western defined norm. And I'm ranting now. I feel I'm getting stressed now because I was so upset by that, because it gave license from the so-called liberal media in Ireland to open up a whole misogynistic and anti-Muslim inferences around that.
Claire, can I pull a few threads though with you? We've spoken about Syria, we've spoken about Iraq, and we've spoken then in the background about Iran and how they've supported both the Assad regime and supported driving out of ISIS from Iraq. The inference is very clear then when you start pulling on this big geopolitical game. I mean, Mick, you've made some statements recently about China and about, you know, we talk about Russia, we talk about China, we talk about the big game that's actually being played by Western imperialism versus, you know, what we'd call the non-aligned countries.
Yeah, I mean, in relation to my comments on China, and I've said a lot about China in the parliament here, and I've done a few interviews as well with some Chinese media. And what I've been calling for is that there's, when Trump was in power and he started this anti-China rhetoric, the Europeans didn't want to know about it, and they said, this is not good. But when Biden came in, and just before Trump's period ended, this anti-China rhetoric started to ratchet up. And it's reached an unprecedented scale in the European Parliament at the moment, mm-hmm. and it's irrational. China is not a security risk to the EU. China is not even a security risk to the Americans. The Americans said that China was a security risk to them. There's American warships in the South China Sea. There is no China warships in the Gulf of Mexico. China has bombed no country in 40 years. Do we think that things, would we like to live in China under their system of government? No, we wouldn't. There's repression in China. But I praised the Communist Party for helping to lift 750 million people out of poverty. It couldn't have happened under a capitalist system.
Well, actually, the World Bank claims it did.
Did what?
The World Bank actually includes in its, you know, capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty with its $2 a day limit.
No, I'll tell you what, I beg to differ, right? The World Bank has admitted, and I'll send you the report, the latest World Bank report on it, but they admitted that, I forget the time period, but it was up to 2015, they analysed it. It was only published recently, but they showed that there were 750 million people lifted out of poverty in China, in a country with 1.4 billion people. And they said that that the West and other places were struggling to compete. And places like Africa are struggling to compete as well, because colonialism hasn't gone away. And you take places like Niger and Mali, where 70% of the people are living in poverty, because the French still they're literally colonists still. They're extracting the uranium, paying peanuts for it, and they get all the uranium there, further nuclear, which provides 75% of French electricity. But the end result of it is that the places are falling. falling apart. And they give out about the African governments being corrupt, and they are. But who's corrupting them? I mean, you have big Western business and maybe Russian business, maybe Chinese, but outsiders are bribing the governments to get what they want out of them. We're literally exploiting the place, and we're enshrining poverty wholesale in places like Africa still.
Mm. Mick and Claire, can I just sort of, this is the last thing from me. The charges that are being levelled, or the accusations or inferences that are being levelled at you, are that you are either captured or naive, and that you are swimming against the stream in the EU and you're not doing any good. How do you answer those charges quickly? How do you say it in one sentence? How do you say that, no, we're not captured? No, we're not.
Well,
naive.
I would say that there's 705 MEPs in the European Parliament. We're independent. We think for ourselves. We speak for ourselves. We call it as it is, whereas most of them are in parties and they do what they're told.
Mm. And I think we're not actually swimming against the stream to the extent that the issues have been covered. There will be a whole number of delegations in our own group who very much agree with what we're putting forward. And there's loads of citizens in Europe who agree with what we're putting forward as well. I mean, we're not captured by anybody. We've never, ever supported any regime. And actually, this is becoming now a way of silencing dissent on foreign policy issues. So anybody who speaks up for an independent EU foreign policy, breaking out of the coattails of the US, for the EU to be independent, to have relations with everybody, to engage with diplomacy, instead of engaging in the arguments, slurs like fake news, conspiracy theorists, you know, you're captured, oh, you're only in Egypt. That's how they respond rather than engage. And I actually think it's actually scary, because while all the talk about how democratic the EU is, there's a creeping authoritarianism in this, and we see it in all of the dialogue around foreign interference
and
stuff.
Can I ask then? Can I ask one question then? That maybe leads on from Martin's. Why are you doing it? Why choose these battles?
Well, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm on the Security and Defence Committee. It's my job.
I know, but Mick, it's like, you know, there's you could go off and you could easily turn around and say, I'm on the Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm the rapporteur for Iraq, but I will sit there and I will see.
I'll sit there, you know, and I'll do nothing. Seriously, you're right. I could do that. And I could just keep my head down, just do the bits and pieces. Listen, in Brussels, right, you can come over here as an Irish MEP and do absolutely nothing and get away with it and take the money. No problem. Or you can come over here and work your balls off and you get the same credit, you get the same money. And I mean, listen, it depends on your own, everyone's individual approach. Everyone decides to do what themselves, what they think they should do.
And I think it is an important question, Tony, right? But if you look at it, right, all the criticism and all the focus is on the fact that we went to Iraq and we went to Syria. But we went to Venezuela and we went to Ecuador, as did many of our colleagues. Some agree on those issues, some disagree. That's the nature of democracy. But actually what the media don't cover is, we've been in the European Parliament for 2 years. Those visits, I think we were working it out on those visits that we made. I think, how many days did we miss?
Four
days we missed. In all of that other time, yes, Mick has to do his foreign affairs bit. We both try and defend Ireland's neutrality and stand up against the arms industry. But we've been to the forefront on issues like Mick's on the Environment Committee. I'm on the Transport Committee, raising aviation workers, to the forefront of data security file, challenging Europol on policing. There hasn't been a single mention. I was invited to represent the people of Bulgaria at their protest because I've been to the forefront of rule of law. You never hear any of that in the Irish media. So we don't concentrate on these things. But the European Union has an agenda where foreign affairs is now dominating. It dominates all the plenary discussions, and we're responding to an agenda which is trying to isolate a viewpoint that argues for diplomacy and for peace and against militarism, because this has been driven by the arms industry. 5 years ago, there was none of the same rhetoric against Russia, but it's been ratcheted up now, and it's been driven by the 600,000 or whatever, 6,000 plus lobbyists based here in Brussels.
It's funny enough, again, for listeners' benefits, there's I think it's 50% more lobbyists in Brussels than there are in Washington,
D.C. Yeah, unreal.
Just to put that in.
And the most powerful lobbyists at the moment are the arms industry.
Unbelievable, yeah. So you have to be at war with somebody, and that's what they're doing.
And
I don't doubt that, guys. But I want to ask about Russia before we let you go, if that's sure. Okay. There's a lot of people now, and the accusation is very. It's out there. You see the social media posts and that you know too cozy and seeking clout from Russia. What do you say to that accusation?
Well, I thought it was gas. Like the people in here, a few of them would say, go back to Russia. And I said, well, I've never been there in the first place, so I have no connections with any politician. Find me a quote anywhere where we praised any politician in Russia, Putin or otherwise. We never have. Like, that's just utter nonsense. But there are 5 million Russian speakers in the EU. There is certainly an agenda coming from the Eastern European countries on the border with Russia, where they constantly go on about Russia all the time. But that's not actually helpful, we don't think. We think there should be. Russia are part of Europe. They're our neighbour. We should be resolving things with them and differences through dialogue and engagement, not through ratcheting up a military or securitized agenda.
The citizens of Europe are not interested in another Cold War with Russia or a new one with China. They think that engagement makes more sense. China, for example, is the EU's biggest trading partner now. Our biggest trading partner. But the Americans don't like that. And the Americans are trying to drive a wedge between the EU and China.
Yeah, but China said something recently about wanting to bring Taiwan back into the fold.
I know that, yeah. I mean, that's another debate, and you can understand it.
I'm just using this again. You can't, there's...
But they didn't say they're going to bomb Taiwan to Kingdom Come. Listen, the Chinese have become the
second biggest economy in the world, and they'll be the biggest probably within 10 years without dropping a bomb on anyone, without sanctioning anyone back into the Stone Age. And they've done it in an independent fashion, right? Look what the American...
People in Hong Kong might disagree with you.
Do you know how many protesters have been killed by the Chinese police in Hong Kong? Zero, right? In the last 3 months alone, right, there are over 100 protesters killed in Colombia, but the EU will not say a word to Duque, the dictator, who is a far-right leader, and the EU supports him. And we have our own Eamon Gilmore, the EU envoy out there, and he's literally been... refusing to call the truth out if what's happening in Colombia. Colombia is per head of population has one of the worst human rights records in the world today, and the EU has no problem with it. But we've discussed Hong Kong in the plenary 5 times since we got here, and not one protester has been killed there yet.
I have to say, and listening to what Claire has said about the other work that you're doing with aviation and workers and stuff like that, do you not find it a little disappointing that all of that is lost in the white noise about trips to Iraq that don't have to be made?
That's not, well, it would have been, so all we get is the white noise. I've been doing all those other things anyway. There's been articles written in The Guardian about the work I've done on data protection, on the protection of refugees on Europe's borders, particularly in relation to a row with the Croatian authorities, where we really shook waves, if you like. I'm nearly a household name in Bulgaria because of my rule of law work. Any Irish journalist could have had access to that information. It's not that hard. They choose not to cover it. And that in and of itself gives you an idea of what's going on here. This is demonisation. It's trying to silence a left-wing view. It's nothing to do. Other than that, our work wouldn't get... We don't get coverage anyway on the other stuff because they couldn't be bothered, you know.
Yeah, but the point needs to be made that we're not doing what we're doing in the European Parliament so that we get coverage in the media in Ireland. Right, we do what we think we should do. We work very hard. Our staff work very hard. We have an amazing staff team, the two of us, and they're making a huge impression on an awful lot of work in the European Parliament. And listen, the Irish media don't have to cover it. I mean, but we feel responsible about what we need to do, and we're working hard, and that's all we can do.
Yeah, I mean, look. Yeah.
Can I ask one last thing? Do you regret leaving the doll?
No.
No, I mean, and it's terrible. Like, and I'm quite sure, like, it's so bad now in Ireland, the way COVID has been mishandled and everything. It's just, if we had been in the doll now, it seems to be incredibly dysfunctional and difficult. I think we were able to function more normally. Not that the European Parliament is normal. I'd hate to give that impression. It definitely isn't. But I suppose we were able to do a lot more, like, and rattle a lot more cages by being where we were, like, you know. But yeah, I mean, I don't think there's...
No, I mean, so we spent 8.5 years in the Dáil, both of us. We were both elected in 2011. And yeah, we'd like to think that we made an impression and we made a difference in the Dáil. And we would like to think that we're doing the same here. I enjoyed the experience at the Dáil and I'm enjoying the experience here. And I want to make a difference. I want to make the world a better place for all the citizens of the world to live in. And how we do is... is a challenge, obviously, but we do our best.
And I think, you know, a really important point on that, because it's true, increasingly so much of what is happening in Ireland is coming out of Europe, and we could have a programme on its own, and God knows we banged the drum enough about our neutrality and about the defence industry and the military industrial complex here in the EU, which is actually scary, the amount of EU taxpayers' money now for the first time being directly spent on militarism and military hardware and so on. All these things are affecting people in Ireland and they don't get discussed at home. So one of the initiatives we had, and we're trying to get, we had a motion tabled at the plenary on it, was a sort of an Oireachtas type TV, a European Parliament TV, not to cover us, to cover all the MEPs from other countries, because what they're doing, because the knowledge of what goes on here is much better in other countries than it is in Ireland. And I think the only way to overcome that is not leaving it in the hands of journalists who cherry pick pieces to get a bit of publicity for themselves or whatever, but to actually show what goes on here in all its unedited formats so that people can tune into it. And we've actually done huge analysis on that, and we've a programme ready to go for how, in a cost-effective, very easy way, we could have a European Parliament TV which would reveal all this.
And when we first put it forward in the Parliament, and we put a proposal forward, and it was voted on.
Got a lot of support, believe it or not. We're not actually outliers.
You'd be shocked to hear that some Irish MEPs voted against it.
Yeah.
Can I just push in and say, Mick Wallace, Clare Daly, you do make an impact, and the... I'm sure that in time we will fully understand the impact that you made. But we'd like to thank you both for coming on, having this chat with us this morning. Hopefully we've enlightened a few people. Hopefully we've raised a few questions that haven't been raised. And thank you for coming and having this
Thanks
chat
Thanks a million
with us.
For having us. Hopefully we didn't confuse things too much, but people can feel free to get in contact with us if they desire any further clarity.
Thank you very much.
I hope we've enraged a few people, and maybe we'll there's a lot more to come on this, and I think it's really important that we have this conversation, and I want to thank you for that. Just to let listeners know, we're back this afternoon with Mike Ryan, Mr. Head of the WHO, so that should be interesting as well. Keep an eye on your feeds, and we will talk to you all very, very soon. Thanks very much for listening. Take care. Bye bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.